It's The Wonky Show. We're talking expanding higher education, spiking, minimum entry and free speech. It's all coming up.
So let me take a moment to inform the intolerant few that their brief period of power is in fact over. Because I have no hesitation in saying that diversity of opinion is just as important as diversity of background. The freedom to disagree is just as important as the freedom to agree. And democracy does not end at the gates of your echo chamber.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach. And joining me at the start of our new season are three brilliant guests as ever to help rewind the HD policy tape and hope it doesn't get jammed in the proverbial machine along the way. In Nottingham, it's Paul Greatrix, University of Nottingham's Registrar. Paul, your highlight of the week.
My highlight of the week was a blast from the past, a return to my youth as I went to see Lloyd Cole playing some of his old hits and newer numbers the other night. Very entertaining indeed, very nostalgic.
No idea who that is. And in South East London, it's Diana Beach. In South East London, it's Diana Beach, Chief Executive of London Hire. Diana, your hire for the week.
Hi, Mark. I have no idea who that is either, so sorry. As for my highlight of the week, I know this is shameless of me, but this week's actually my birthday week, and it's my first one without some form of restrictions for the past couple of years. So by the time this show goes out, I'll hopefully be celebrating up in Glasgow, where I'm going to be going to a friend's wedding anyway over the weekend. So it's celebrations all round, really, and I think some much-needed downtime this long weekend before the DfE consultation deadlines hit us all next week. Sorry to remind you all.
Yes, that was a bit of a rollercoaster right there, sort of celebration and DfE consultation deadline. Yeah. More on that later. And in Exeter, it's Sunday Blake, Wonky's associate editor. Sunday, your highlight of the week.
Well, my highlight of the week was finalising the panel discussions for Access All Areas, which is obviously the event we have coming up on the 10th of May. And it's so exciting because it's just going to be amazing. And I'm really excited about it because obviously we haven't had an event since Secret Life of Students. But now that Diana's said, it's also my birthday week. So now I'm wondering if me and Diana have the same birthday. Mine's on Saturday.
Oh, mine's on Friday. Royal Wedding Day, 29th of April.
Happy birthday, everyone.
Happy birthday,
and come to
all.
Access All Areas on the 10th of May. That's right. Absolutely right. Good. Now, let's start the week with the Tony Blair Institute's big report into higher education. It's causing lots of discussion. Paul, talk us through it.
So the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. Now, I was just criticised a moment ago for no one knowing who Lloyd Cole was. He's a contemporary of Tony Blair's, but many more people have heard of Tony Blair and have very strong opinions on him. So the Institute last week produced a report arguing for a much greater participation rate. So up to 70% participation rate in higher education by 2040. And harks back, of course, to the original target, which has been much commented on, of 50% going into higher education, which was exceeded not that long ago. But it's become a real kind of focus for both opposers and those in favour of higher education, and has become somewhat fetishised. But the report itself is very much about looking at the broader swathe of higher education qualifications at level four and above, and arguing that actually what our country needs in order to ensure long-run productivity is more people going into higher education of different types to ensure that we're able to get the productivity we need. And it's a rational case, but unfortunately I think has been rather overshadowed by people's prejudices and interpretations of what higher education participation means. So there's a lot in there to chew on, Mark.
Diana, would I be right in saying that the government is sort of pretending to disagree with what's in the Tony Blair Institute's report?
Yeah, so we're certainly in a climate of contradictions at the moment, aren't we? We've got, I'm sure we'll come onto it later as well, but as you say, we've got minimum entry requirements and student number controls being considered, but then a lifelong learning agenda, which in many ways should do what is being set out in this Tony Blair Institute report. I mean, I don't know about you or any of our listeners today, but I get really irked when I hear people questioning how many people should be going into higher education. And I get irked because what you're basically doing is asking how many people people shouldn't be going to university as well? It's implicit in the question. Nobody would dare ask that or indeed put a number on it. So maybe that's what we should be doing instead, to cut through all the noise and to, you know, undermine the government's argument at the moment. Because I hope everyone agree that everybody should get the chance to raise their educational attainment when, if they want it. And we'd be better off putting our efforts into how working out how to do this, and be that by tackling low school attainment or developing more non-traditional routes. So I think that's really what the government should be focusing on.
The point is that the Tony Blair's Institute's report is not the policy of up to 70% by 2040 isn't necessarily different to the government's policy. They've not set a target. All they've said is that they don't agree with the Tony Blair target. But with expanding lifelong learning opportunities, as you're saying, you know, that number could creep up. We're not talking about sending everyone for a full-time undergraduate campus-based degree, are we?
I think that's exactly the point, Mark. And I mean, too often these things get seen through, you know, a bit of a tabloid lens, which sees every undergraduate experience as being Oxbridge fundamentally, or, you know, golf studies. So there, you know, and that those are the only kind of ways in which to describe an undergraduate experience. It's much, much broader than that, as you and Diana say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say this, I work for him. I appreciate Lord Johnson's forward to the report as well. I think he sets that out quite nicely. And I don't think you can emphasise enough what is happening in other parts of the world. He mentioned South Korea, Japan and Canada, I think, as high innovation economies. I mean, participation rates in these countries are already between 60 and 70%. They've already made that sort of a milestone, but they do it because they've got a broad definition of higher education, and that's something that we desperately need to work towards.
Lord Johnson, of course, being Joe Johnson, former universities minister, right? I mean, Sunday, the debates, it's not surprising how toxic this debate has been, is it? And it seems like, I mean, the Tony Blair Institute's, they know exactly what they're doing. It's a very canny piece of policy work, building on, you know, the Tony Blair's original 50% target, which is just so totemic. And the government claim not to want to respect it, but you know, the fact is we've already reached it, and the other fact is it's absolutely shaped the higher education system that we have today, in that the investment and expansion of higher education that followed that original target has led to many more people having a higher education. Almost can't be quantified, you know, the kind of, in terms of productivity, in terms of equality, in terms of all sorts of things that, you know, will have happened as a result of that. It's almost hard to quantify. But there is something nastier about this, isn't there? Because the people who don't want, the people who think there should be fewer students, they tend to be talking about other people, don't they? They tend to be talking about their children.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I was going to say it's really certain which demographics are looking down at the idea of expanding higher education. I do agree with what Paul was saying. It's that there is sometimes a deliberate misunderstanding around Tony Blair's sort of original figure, or even the updated figure. And I think that it's often the way that it's spoken about. So as you know, Paul said, everyone thinks it's full-time campus-based Oxbridge, but not everyone that higher education was going to be opened up to is going to study something like romantic literature. And one of the things that I always do around these conversations is take them to friends who never went to university. So I explained this to a friend of mine who is a builder, and he employs, you know, young lads sort of like 18 up. And his immediate response was like, well, okay, well, who's going to do my work if they all go to university, if all these lads start going to university and studying philosophy? And obviously that wasn't the case. And I think there's like a lack of transparency around what qualifications and what skills students were being equipped with. Because like you said, it's not Oxbridge, it's not golf studies. There's a plethora of qualifications that can be offered to students that will give them all types of skills.
I won't hear words said against golf studies on The Wonky Show.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I had a birthday party last weekend, and I had my friend Ben, who's a builder, you know, no GCSEs, anything like that. And he was talking to my friend Matt, he's got several degrees in construction. And it was so interesting to see them talk to each other about the exact same sector, but coming at it from different angles. I think that when we shroud higher education in sort of elitism, we forget that actually there's a lot of people with a lot of skill and a lot of talent that could add to the conversations here that currently aren't being welcomed in.
I think it's absolutely right. And part of the vision for a productive economy has got to be ensuring that we have people who are able to span that range of activity, right? And, you know, so the people that your friend Ben's employing, right, need to have the basic skills to enable them to start off on their construction journey, but also need to have access to, you know, to apprenticeships, etc., to get them on a ladder towards progressing further. And it may be they don't want to go further, or they do, but they need both the academic structure to enable that to happen, but also the financial incentives for both employers and for institutions to enable it to happen as well. Essentially, we need to take a lot of the politics out of education to enable us to design a system which works from top to bottom, from left to right. And it is too ideological. You're right, it's about people wanting to, you know, pull up the drawbridge and say, no one else is allowed to study art history now because I'm happy and my children are happy. That's not on. We've got to view it through a completely different lens.
But it's not even about the subject, though. Like, I know you're saying art history, but I find that sort of like gatekeeping isn't around particular subjects. It's around like the concept of a degree itself. The idea that like, well, I have a degree in my specialism, and you know, we're joking here about golf studies, but you know, there's this kind of snobbery around like, well, my degree singles me out above other people who don't have degrees, and whatever their specialism is or whatever their labor contribution to society is, there has to be something that indicates that it's lower than mine. When it's not, because, you know, the way that we value labour is, you know, we value labour in society as the sort of like brain versus brawn, right? Like the more brain that you use, the better it is or whatever, which obviously is not the case at all. But there is, I think that it comes down to this idea of like, well, I have a degree and their particular specialism can't possibly be quantified via degree, because a degree is what makes my specialism better than theirs, which is absurd.
I think you might be onto something with the brain versus brawn thing, Sunday. I like that. I was just going to say, I mean, what we've suffered from for too long in our sector is the division, the nonsensical division between technical, vocational and academic education, when, you know, academic is technical too and vice versa. We need to be breaking that down. I'm not saying I know an easy way how to do it, but I think you're definitely onto something.
Yeah, I completely agree. And just on the golf thing, I grew up in a golfing village and I can absolutely endorse the need for proper structured golf education for people at all levels of golf.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, Andy Grayson here. My piece on assessment challenges and employability comes from a career-long interest in systematic observational methods and sequential analysis. From this perspective, the predominance of static snapshot outcome measures that strip out the dimension of time from human behaviour is a real shortcoming of psychology. And it turns out also to be a real shortcoming of traditional methods of assessing skills in higher education. This piece focuses on the question of how we should assess students on the skill of working collaboratively as part of a team. It notes the traditional tendency to focus on the outcomes of group work when it comes to this kind of assessing, and makes the case for a need to focus instead on dynamic measures of process.
Now there's been a new report out about spiking. Sunday, talk us through it.
So, yeah, there's a new report from the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee inquiry into spiking. This comes off the back of sort of countrywide demonstrations, protests, online petitions to essentially get the safety of students and other people who go into the nighttime economy prioritised. This is really relevant to higher education because there's a statistic that says that 81% of reported spiking victims are students. And plus the Home Office has been asked by the committee to work with third party stakeholders such as universities alongside licensed premises, local authorities and the police to develop anti-spiking strategies. The report also sets out a recommendation that spiking is made a criminal offence in and of itself. A lot of people sort of aren't aware that actually spiking someone is not an offence. It's just any sort of kind of lateral offences that happen around the spiking incident. So like an assault or a theft. And then obviously the report followed with a longer term call that a strategy is published and used to develop national policy.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting report. But I mean, for me, I think the proportion of reported spikings, 81% being students, is just staggering. So it does say there's something very, very unusual going on in relation to our student communities, and that is really strange, and we need to investigate that.
Can I ask
further?
So just on that point, Paul, does that ring true for your experience? I know you've long tracked the criminal activity that happens on your campus. There's a book out about that very topic. But does it ring true?
Well, I think, because what I'm not able to gauge is the other non-student incidents of this kind, which do get reported to the police. But I think that there part of the thing is, right, that the work that universities and particularly students' unions do to encourage people to protect themselves in all dimensions of their student lives, particularly when they're, you know, out in a potentially slightly unsafe environment, like a club in town kind of thing. I think that does promote the idea that reporting, you know, is an important thing to do. Lots of people clearly don't report, but perhaps more students are inclined to report because they're more aware of the issue than the wider youth population. I don't know.
Also,
I'm speculating.
No. I completely agree with that, because I actually think that students have more venues of support when they do find themselves in, you know, an intoxicated state. So like if you're a student, you go back to your halls, you've got welfare officers, you've got hall staff, you've got campus medical centres who can go, something's wrong here, let's call the police. But if you're a non-student, you just go home. Do you know what I mean? And you're not going to have that support to get your case taken to the police. So
I think that's an absolutely valid point. The other point I was going to make is that I do think efforts, right, and I know there are criticisms of the approach and these, but efforts which bring together universities, students' union, the police, city councils, licensing authorities, and club owners and their security staff, to ensure the greater safety of students when they're in what are, you know, kind of dodgy environments often. I think that those steps and those shared understandings and the wider measures of safety that can be taken, including in relation to the incidence of spiking, I think is a positive thing. And I think they should be happening all the time anyway, regardless of a particular issue and focus on spiking.
This is one of the things that frustrates me so, so much with the whole kind of spiking, like is someone spiked or have they been drunk, like rhetoric, is the idea that if a student has been spiked, then they deserve healthcare and they deserve being looked after. But if they're just drunk, then they don't, and that they're just chucked out of clubs or they're sent home. It's like, no, we need to forget why someone is in the state that they're in, and we need to support them and help them. And it just really frustrates me that there's this kind of like there's like a divide between what person deserves help and what doesn't. It's like and then that's why there's so much onus on like people having to prove that they've been spiked, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, why does someone have to prove it?
And that you're depending on a split second judgment by a member of door staff about whether someone, you know, it's been spiked, they're drunk, they're ill, they might be having some kind of other physical symptoms relating to a long-term illness, etc., etc. And also that points to the need for proper training for security staff, which plays into the point we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to chip in here. I think there's something to be said for that joined up approach, because we've been tracking this issue from a London perspective, if it helps to give sort of a regional dimension. And I was shocked when I saw a survey by the TAB, I think it was in October last year, saying that 43% of London students surveyed by them said they've either been spiked themselves or know someone who has. And on the back of that, I know the Mayor of London then urged women in the capital to report any incidences of spiking that they may have been victim to or seen someone be victim to by either needle or drink. And I don't know where that's got to, but what I do know is that certainly last month, the Mayor of London has made it one of his priorities in a campaign aimed at tackling violence against women and all associated incidences, and this could sort of fall into that. So I do think we now have an opportunity at that regional level to elevate this issue and to sort of force that join up.
I completely agree with you. I do think that we need to be really careful when we're looking at self-reported incidences. And that's not to say that I don't believe that someone wasn't concerned about their own well-being, but a lot of the symptoms of spiking are the exact same symptoms as a panic attack. So sweaty palms, raised heartbeat, feeling a bit dizzy and disorientated. And I think that there is a lot going on at the moment with people talking about spiking. So like, you know, as a relatively young person, like, I've gone out before and someone said to me on Sunday, I think you got spiked at your birthday. And I'm like, well, actually, I didn't, but I'm 8'11" and every single person decided to buy me a drink and I got a bit worse for wear. But obviously, if someone comes up to you and says, you're a bit wobbly, I think you've been spiked, and you know that spiking is being talked about a lot and that everyone's saying it's happening. If someone said that to me on that night, I'd immediately start panicking, you know? And one of the great recommendations, and I'm not downplaying it, because I think it's a horrendous and terrifying thing to imagine coming to terms with the fact that someone's deliberately tried to harm you. It's horrific. But that's exactly why I don't think we should be putting the idea into people's heads unless we can prove it. And there is a recommendation into the report that people who think they've been spiked should be able to access quality healthcare, responsible policing and rapid forensic testing. And that is 100% the right decision, not because I think everyone's being spiked, because one, I think healthcare approach is the right one, whether someone has or hasn't, you know, they're frightened and they need help. But two, if we actually start testing student union, students, and I know some student unions have started doing this, we might actually be able to get a clear picture of what's happening, but also reassure some students. So Surrey, they started testing students and they found out of 120 students who said they'd been spiked, only 6 tested positive. And Lincoln tested 35 students saying they'd been spiked and only 1 person tested positive. And again, I'm coming back to this thing of saying, I'm not saying that I'm not believing people when they say that they're frightened and scared and they think that something's happening to them. Because I think if someone's coming to you saying they need help, we need to believe them. And, you know, people have good reason to believe they might be spiked, because violence against women is an epidemic in this country. But I'm saying that we really need to take a data-based approach to this. So when we start actually testing people and we see that spiking isn't happening as often as it is, one, we can reassure people. But the other thing we can do is say, okay, so what are the reasons that you're getting into this physical state? Is it that you don't understand your alcohol tolerance? Is it that you're not eating enough? Is it, as the report also acknowledged, that your friends are giving you more alcohol than you think that they're giving you, because, you know, they're sort of just eyeballing what they think is a shot in a kitchen somewhere and not using a professional optic, and giving their friend a 75ml shot of vodka instead of a 25. And do you see what I'm saying? Like, once we actually sit down and go, right, what is the problem? It's not as big as we think it is, but that's not to say that there aren't problems, because they are, but we just need to find out exactly what they are.
Now, all this season, we're working with the Association of University Administrators to bring you dispatches from the desks of hardworking HE professionals from around the country. And this week, we caught up with Malazri Home and Freya Douglas Oloyedi, who are working to tackle gender, disability and ethnic pay gaps at Newcastle University.
Hi, welcome to The Wonky Show. Can you each introduce yourselves?
I am Freya Douglas Oloyedi. I'm an Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Advisor at Newcastle University. I've been working on EDI in the HE sector since 2010, so lots of experience in this area, both at the Equality Challenge Unit and then later at Newcastle University.
Hi, I'm Malazri Home, and I'm the Race Equality and Accreditation Advisor at Newcastle University. I lead on work around the Race Equality Charter and join up the Race Equity Agenda and community work as well.
So why is pay gap such a focus for you at Newcastle?
It's such a focus for us because we've really set it as an institutional priority. You know, this is one of our 3 top key commitments in our University Athena Swan Action Plan, which is basically our gender equality plan. And while we've made some progress in reducing the gap since 2017, we absolutely accept it's still too high. And that's why it's a really important focus for us. The other thing I'd say is that it's not just the gender pay gap that's important to us, but also ethnicity pay gaps and disability pay gaps. gaps are really important. We don't want any gaps relating to any equality group. And so that's why we've taken that approach at Newcastle to look beyond gender.
And of all the things you've done working on pay gaps, what do you feel has been the most effective thing?
So I think from my perspective, the most effective thing that has happened has been going first beyond a rudimentary analysis by ethnicity to look at groupings and subgroupings. So, for example, looking at early career researchers on contracts and professors separately, in addition to considering academic colleagues. And then it was to build in an intersectional approach where possible. So, for example, looking at gender and ethnicity both within these groupings.
And what's been the biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge with the gender pay gap and other pay gaps is that the causes of them are structural, systemic, historic, ingrained, so you can't change them overnight. So mostly we're talking about making small incremental changes that over time lead to more equitable outcomes. So that's a challenge because we all want to make dramatic changes as soon as we can, of course. So it's that maintaining momentum and commitment to this that's really key, and focusing efforts on this for a longer period of time in order to see results.
And thinking about that then, what's your absolute one best top tip for other colleagues across the sector working on this topic?
I would say it's really three things rolled into one rather than one tip. So it's know your data, because there will be gaps. Know your organization, because that is important to build a sense of belonging. And finally, build intersectionality wherever possible.
Thank you so much.
The Institute of Fiscal Studies is weighing back into the higher education policy debate with a report into minimum entry requirements. Paul, run us through this.
So the IFS have done a really a brief, interesting, punchy report on minimum eligibility requirements. What this is all about is saying that students wishing to enter higher education cannot access a student loan system unless they meet certain minimum entry requirements. This is the latest wheeze from government. And the idea is that you would not be eligible for a loan unless you had got the equivalent of an old C grade in GCSE English and maths, or grade 4 in contemporary currency. And the reasons for this are twofold. One is it's an attempt to somehow limit the exposure of the Treasury to the student loan book, so restricting access to loans. And the other thing is it's another crude ideological attack on higher education and our ability to admit people that we think have got the potential to progress and to complete their degrees. So it's a different constraint on institutions in terms of who they admit. The wider challenge of it is it would have a disproportionate impact on those already underrepresented in higher education. It would lead to further skill shortages of the kind we've already described, but it runs entirely counter to the other regulatory strand government is interested in, which is access and participation, which the Office for Students is currently pushing very hard. So it causes a whole bunch of problems.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump straight in because this is very much my topic of the month. Obviously, we're working on this in advance of the HE reform consultation deadline next week. And it really, what the IFS has found really chimes with what we're seeing in London. So we've been working with the GLA to collect data. And just to give a regional nuance on this, we're actually seeing that almost half of free school meal eligible pupils would be excluded if minimum entry eligibility requirements, are to be set at the GCSE level. 40% of black London pupils and a staggering 86% of pupils with special educational needs. So really, I can't emphasise enough, there's a clear disproportionate impact for certain student groups. And that is certainly what we will be pushing in our consultation response. And I'm sure that's just mirrors what's going on elsewhere in the sector as well. And of course, none of that is considering the disruption that COVID has brought to pupils' lives over the past couple of years as well. I mean, time will tell what the impact of COVID will be on the educational journey of, primary school kids today who want to go to university. If we bring minimum eligibility requirements back at GCSE or A-levels, that's set to lock out generations of students who could have the potential to benefit from tertiary education, not even higher education, and succeed. Yeah.
Isn't this the idea, though? I mean, just genuinely, I'm trying to ask this question in good faith. Does the government want to just reduce the amount of people going to higher education for cost reasons? Is that, is kind of, you got that on one hand? Or is it that they actually want to kind of engineer society skews it in this kind of grossly unequal way, as the IFS points out? It's a bit of a leading question.
I mean, I'll go first. I certainly hope it's not the latter. I hope, you know, no one can play God with people's futures. I mean, even with the best intentions in the world, we cannot predict the skills that are needed of tomorrow and the way the world of work will go. I mean, we would have predicted COVID coming if we'd known that. So, I mean, I do think that the immediate pressure at the moment is the RAB charge, looking at the Treasury books, looking at the RAB charge going up, the amount of taxpayer money that's subsidising education. That will be setting alarm bells going, particularly in a time of increasing financial pressures. We're seeing rising inflation. COVID cost a lot of money to the Treasury. The Treasury is going to be looking for ways to pull back costs. But really, we need to detach the immediate goal from the long-term goal. I mean, yeah, we can fix that now, but what's that going to do to our future economy? Probably governments don't care because they work so short-term, more short-term than ever, I think, at the moment. You know, that's a problem for the next government, but it really shouldn't.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the future funding of further and higher education was all meant to be resolved by Augur. It wasn't, and it hasn't been, and it isn't going to be. We do need a longer term solution for all of our education, particularly post-compulsory education system. But what the consequence of this is all about, as it's all about short-termism. It's all about trying to stop a particular problem with the size of the and growth of the loan book. And I'm afraid I do think that there are people who are, you know, quite happy with, you know, reintroducing barriers to prevent people from certain backgrounds entering higher education because it's, you know, perceived as not for them. And I think this is a really unfortunate and really wildly inappropriate way of doing just that. And just, you know, just so there will be a part of the population that's completely unconcerned about this, right? Because it won't affect them or their children or their children's children, right? It won't. Because they know that they're going to get their GCSEs, they know they're going to get their A-levels, and they're going to be able to go to their choice of university or at least one of them. And that's just grand. But there are a large part of the population who aspire to progress to education for whom this is going to be yet another barrier in an already very, very challenging environment. And that's not what this country needs or wants. We've got to give people the opportunity to progress.
What one point that I was sort of thinking of this morning when I was reading this report was that this has a real potential to have almost like a vicious cycle knock-on effect. So when you look at, so obviously, you know, they're talking about the impact that this could have on, well, first of all, I don't like the definition of like low value degrees. There's a whole other conversation to have there. But, you know, DK was making a really good point on the site about how there's certain subjects that this is going to impact more than others. And one of them is nursing and the other one is social care. And I was thinking this morning that, you know, students who've had, so students in social care can also, like a lot of them have come from a background where they've had interactions with social care. So if you limit the number of students from social care who can study social care, you're going to limit the number of social workers we have in a couple of years, which means that the care system is going to be in an even worse state than it is, which means that even fewer care leavers or care experienced students are going to get to university because they're not getting the interventions that they need. And what you're going to end up with is almost a whole subsection of society that is just completely blocked from social mobility, progression, further education, because you're taking away the labour force from that area. And then obviously DK also mentioned nurses, and it blows my mind. Like it's just unfathomable that we can be coming out of a pandemic and we have a government looking at demographics that make up a certain medical degree and saying, actually, we don't want you to study that.
Absolutely great point, Sunday. And that's why I want to say, for anybody listening to this show before the 6th of May, please use the opportunity that we've got in the HE consultation, HE reform consultation, to pull out these inconsistencies. Because I know from my time in Whitehall, and I said it yesterday at the HEPI conference as well, that government departments don't speak to each other. And we need to be pulling out those inconsistencies. If something is going to affect a government ambition in another area or another department, then we need to be telling them. And then, Paul, you've just mentioned how this contradicts A&P agenda. Sunday, you've just mentioned how this sort of contradicts our ambition to build up, you know, our healthcare and social care base. We need to be emphasising that. So please, whatever you are, put in those consultation responses.
Yeah, there's also just say the other issues on the table. There were student number controls, the foundation years, and other things as well. So yeah, get your consultation in, your response in, add your voice to the weight of people saying what a bad idea this is, and sadly watch it be ignored by ministers. Who should go to university, and why? What is social mobility these days anyway? And are we heading for a more joined up tertiary education system in England and across the UK? Join us in May for Access All Areas, a wonky event where we'll assess the current access and participation landscape and consider what we need to change in terms of outreach, information, advice and guidance, partnerships and pathways between providers, and on-course student support to sustain and grow educational opportunity in the years ahead. We'll bring together policymakers and practitioners to work through the challenges, including the new OFS Director for Fair Access and Participation, John Blake, and identify the things that will make the most difference to future students' ability to get in and get on. That's Access All Areas, Tuesday the 10th of May in London. Find out more at wonky.com/events. See you there. So, the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill is back in action. Diana, what's going on?
Yeah, so this is a gift that just keeps on giving, really, isn't it? As you said, the free speech bill is back. But I suppose it technically never went away. It's just that it never got very far in its passage through Parliament over the past year. So I guess many of us were starting to ponder whether it would get timed out at the end of this parliamentary session or not. But alas, it hasn't. Earlier this week, a carryover motion was approved without division, which basically means that the free speech bill lives to see another day. Hurrah. So to mark the occasion, the university's minister, Michelle Donnellan, gave a speech at the Policy Exchange think tank the very next day, in which I think she quite menacingly warned vice chancellors to ensure that they don't end up on the wrong side of history. And I know that the minister said that for her, it's all about creating a culture change that will reverberate through the sector. But after that speech, I can't help but think that the only thing that's reverberating through the sector right now is quite a lot of confusion, actually, about what this bill is actually going to change in practice and why we need it on top of the existing legislation that's out there.
So vice chancellors, university staff and students should not be on the wrong side of history here. I say to them, do not allow the history books to record your name as part of the small cabal of the intolerant. Look ahead and be part of a freer, fairer and more tolerant future.
We've done our best to take this piece of legislation and in good faith and look at what it's trying to achieve. And the more I read Michelle Donnellan, the more I listen to her talk, she's got another article in Conservative Home out this week, the more confused I am about what it is they're actually looking to do. And it just seems like an absolute mess.
It's more than a mess. I mean, I'm going to be quite controversial, but say I find it quite odd that if a university's minister wants to be known for pushing a big ticket policy item through, that they'd even think about choosing free speech. Because for me, it shows a lack of understanding of the complexity of our sector and particularly our student body. Maybe Sunday you want to come in on this afterwards. But, you know, I'm fortunate in my role at London Higher where I get to work with a really diverse subset of institutions in this country. And for the vast majority of them, free speech just isn't an issue. And I'd say that's largely due to the particular makeup of their student bodies. Many of them have mature students, they're busy, they're enrolled on full-time vocational courses like nursing and social care that we've just spoken about. And for those students, it's difficult enough to attend an extracurricular event on campus, let alone have the energy to try and derail it. And when they can attend, those students want to engage in the debate. They want to hear the different arguments, they want to engage with them. So I just feel the whole free speech issue is predicated on a certain, let's just say, traditionally academic experience of higher education, which many of ministers and officials would have had themselves.
Do you know what? I was going to say that exact point, that they don't realise that university culture has changed since they were like committee members of their university conservative associations. Like they
they're more than that. I think they're kind of re-legislating the debates they had
when they were students.
On campus when they were students. I had these discussions with members of the Conservative Association when I was a student and not a member of the Conservative Association, and there was this constant back and forth about conservatives feeling kind of excluded from political debates, and this was kind of a running theme. This has been, you know, across every campus for decades now. It just feels like the other thing, I just can't believe how overblown some of our language is. I was reading Michelle Donlan's article in Conservative Home unless we stop this intolerant, illiberal minority from ruling the agenda, we will end up incapable of tackling the big issues that matter, as if this is the big issue.
But
and instead, we'll find ourselves in a never-ending culture war. The absolute well, gall
yeah,
of this.
A culture war that they gall. Perpetuate as well.
This piece of legislation is there for the culture war. They're the ones fighting the culture war, right?
Oh, no. And I'm
looking through the mirror here.
You know, there's a vanishingly small number of incidents, which, of course, are the ones that end up on the front page of the Daily Mail, right? Along with the reference to, you know, cancelling Harry Potter and all the rest of it, and trigger warnings on Snow White or Jane Austen or whatever it might be. I mean, it is just, you know, fluff, and it's so marginal. And, you know, the thousands and thousands of events happen every term in every university across the land without any trouble at all. Lots of controversial speakers speak. People get upset about it, you know, for all sorts of reasons. And that's part of university life. This legislation, should they ever actually get it through, if they can actually decide what it is they really want to do, if it ever gets to it, we'll change very, very little in reality, apart from giving, some government chum a nice cosy retainer at the Office for Students as the free speech czar. But it will add nothing to higher education debate. It will add nothing to the student experience. It will do nothing to make us more productive as a sector. It's purely ideological.
So, right, here's the thing, though. Like, it will add some level of detriment because... like student unions are really underfunded. Like the block grants that they're given from their parent institutions barely cover like their operations, right? See, most of the time you've got like one activities manager signing off up to 300 events a week, and that goes up to 1,000 in Freshers Week, right? And they haven't got the funds. So when a society puts in a request for like a controversial speaker, right, and it's normally someone who's very niche in that particular society's interests, that one activities manager is not going to have the background training to like completely understand the implications of that person coming to speak. So what happens is they'll sign it off. They might not do the right risk assessment, whatever, stuff blows up, people are upset, all this kind of thing. The student union has to deal with it. But there is a lot of like confusion. So things like, a politics society getting double booked in a room with the cake society that they were going to make banana bread in. And suddenly this one activities manager, because, you know, they're working for an underfunded organisation, has to postpone the politics event. Now, suddenly some poor president somewhere has got the Free Speech Union in their inbox and LBC asking for an interview. And it's like, actually, if this legislation goes through and that student union is given a massive fine based on a mistake that was made because they're already underfunded and understaffed, I don't think that union is going to then go on to be able to put on good quality academic and political debates, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. What they should be doing is going to vice chancellors, fund your student unions properly so they can put on actual, you know, good political discussions and debates and have like experts and speakers. And because that's the other thing, right? They can't afford good speakers with massive fees, so they get these sort of kind of like political charlatans.
We're not paying for them. But I mean, I think your point about overburdensome regulations is absolutely right. And this is not what student unions are for. They are for creating an environment where students can engage with the issues on their own terms and do so freely and in a secure environment. And that's exactly what we want to do. But yeah, all of this just adds to a burden. It makes it very, very complex and is a gift for the lawyers.
And the other thing they're confused about is the kind of the conflation of academic freedom and free speech. And pushed on this week, Michelle Donlan said she's in listening mode, I think she said. But it makes it, you know, I guess better than speaking mode. I don't know. But I mean, they seem very, very confused about this. We have tried warm words. We have tried appeasement, but none of it has worked. So under my plans, universities are once again going to become fortresses of ideas that are backed by law. This is her article today in Conservative Home. It's embarrassing. It's actually, I'm embarrassed that of all the issues that our country faces, this is what the government is choosing to spend its parliamentary time on an absolute joke. I can't take it in good faith anymore. I've never seen anything like it. And I just, the thing that's really got my goat this morning is Michelle Donlan saying they're doing this to stop fighting, just to stop the endless culture war, when the only people fighting a culture war here are Michelle Donlan and her Conservative ministers, who are just obsessed with this issue because it keeps them talking about things that aren't, you know, uncomfortable. Like,
this is the fourth time I've said this on the podcast, right? But Michelle Donlan took time off her day to tweet that a college in Oxford took down a picture of the Queen. Like, do not tell me that she wants to stop this culture war. Like, this is, she flans the flames at every opportunity.
Okay, well, we've got this bill to look forward to, and we'll be following every twist and turn in the best possible faith that we can muster on wonky.com as it continues its ludicrous passage through Parliament. So, that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our various subscriptions. So thanks very much to Paul, Diana, Sunday, and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. Until next week, stay wonky.